Nichols. Don't make me ask again.
The look he gave her made it clear. He was finished talking about Adele or anything else. Leslie turned on her heel, almost colliding with Annie May, whose smooth, dark face was now a mix of wariness and dread. Her mouth worked mutely for a moment before she dropped her head and turned away. Back in the car, Leslie sat shivering behind the wheel, staring straight ahead and waiting for the heat to thaw her fingers and toes. Eventually, when her circulation had returned, she pulled away from the curb, but as she turned to head back down Old Church Road, she had no doubt that Porter knew exactly what had happened the night the woodshed caught fire, and that whatever had happened was tied to Adele's death. She also knew nothing would ever make him admit it. It was full dark and pouring buckets when Leslie finally pulled into the drive, and unfortunately, she hadn't planned for either, too distracted as she bolted out of the house with Landis Porter's address to grab an umbrella or turn on the porch light. Pulling her jacket up over her head, she darted for the front door and nearly tripped over the packet lying on the doormat. Inside, she tossed her keys and purse on the stairs, flicked on a lamp, slipped out of her coat, and dropped into the nearest chair. Letting her head drop back, she closed her eyes, wishing now that she'd never gone to Level Grove. All the way home, and even now, all she could think about was the telling look on Annie May's face as she stood on Landis Porter's sagging front porch. She had no idea whether Annie May was Porter's wife or his housekeeper, but she was certain the woman knew something. Maybe if she went back to talk to her when Porter wasn't around, though when that might be she really had no idea. The man was almost 90. He was hardly likely to schlep off to work every day. God, she really didn't want to think about it right now. In fact, she wasn't even sure she still wanted to know what had really happened to Adele. It was all too dark and too sad. She was all stocked up on sadness these days. She didn't need any more, especially when it had nothing to do with her. Opening her eyes, she glanced down at the manila envelope resting heavily in her lap. With Christmas around the corner, she had just assumed it was junk mail, a catalog of some sort. Now she noticed the envelope was completely blank, no address of any kind. Tearing open the back flap, she shook out the contents. Her breath caught as the stack of pages slid into her lap, astonished to find Jay's manuscript and a brief handwritten note. Leslie, you've obviously made up your mind, so I won't try to change it. I've enclosed Adele's story, or at least the part I know. It belongs to you. Burn it if you want, but I hope you'll read it first. Maggie never stopped trying to get me to write again. Part of me wonders if this wasn't what she had in mind all along. I can only say, again, how sorry I am about the way things turned out. None of this was what I wanted. Jay. Leslie's belly churned as she read the note for the third time. A part of her wanted to believe what he said, that before Maggie died she had somehow set all this in motion, that what Leslie had initially taken as betrayal was all just part of some great cosmic plan. But the other part, the part that couldn't forget the look on Jay's face when he saw her holding the manuscript, wasn't ready to accept that. And yet, the pages beckoned. It seemed she wasn't as done with her fixation on Adele's death as she'd like to believe, or with Jay either. Chapter 37. Adele. You never love a thing more than when you must leave it. I am miles now from the green girl I was, that foolish girl who sat in Suzanne Gavin's parlor with her eyes on the carpet. I have scars now, wounds that worked themselves so deep into these bones that they live with me still, oozing fresh beneath all this rocky soil. Too late, I learned how tightly we hold to things, to the stuff and the lives we gather around us. When the time comes, when the smoke comes, letting go is impossible. We grasp and claw, unable to relinquish what has been our breath, our heart, perhaps even our ruin. Henry is due back from Smithfield tonight. He's been gone 3 days, talking to some men he knows about a new way to cure tobacco. I have missed him keenly. We made up before he left, or rather, I decided to let the matter of the boys drop. When it comes down to it, Henry's right. I have no say in how Maggie is raised or who she's allowed to run with. The cottage is quiet, the supper dishes put away, a plate warming on the stove. I've put up my hair the way he likes, and I'm wearing my best dress, the one he brought back from Raleigh for my birthday. Jemmy is finally asleep, all arms and sun-browned legs sprawled over the settee, pajamas rucked up around his little belly. It startles me sometimes to see how he's grown, how his limbs have stretched and the baby fat has started to melt away. He's growing into such a solemn little man, his manner so like his daddy's that at times it takes my breath away to see it. I scoop him up in my arms and carry him upstairs. He smells of baby shampoo, milk, and my molasses cookies. His mouth puckers at nothing as I tuck the covers up under his chin, a leftover from the thumb-sucking he seems suddenly to have outgrown. My heart swells as I finger springy bronze curls still damp from bath time, and I wonder if Mama ever felt like this, like she might burst with all the love that seems to gush up from nowhere. He's mine, mine and Henry's, not an heir, but a son, our son. Henry. After all the years and all the hurt, my heart still turns over at the thought of him. When he is away, I can almost believe I hate this place, its lies and charades and heart-tearing sacrifices. And then he comes home, and I know why I have stayed, why I'll always stay. Back downstairs, I hunt for something to do. I pick up my sewing, then a book, but my nerves are too thin for sitting still. I decide to lay a fire, but the woods run low. I tie an old scarf over my head and button on my coat, then cock an ear at the bottom of the stairs. If I hurry, I can fetch the wood and get back before Jemmy wakes. Poor lamb, he's still so afraid of the dark. I can see my breath as I make my way to the woodshed behind the cottage. Moonlight bounces off the old tin roof, thin and white. I shiver and pull up my collar, but not from the cold. There's a kind of prickle between my shoulders. Mama used to call it the third eye. I turn to see Suzanne at her window. She has taken no pains for Henry's homecoming, I see. With the light behind her, she looks like a ghost, her face pale as ash, her hair floating out around her head like a storm cloud. She sees me, I know, in all this moonlight. We cannot make out each other's eyes, but the effect is the same. An instant of loathing so pure it feels like a live thing crackling across all that dark distance. It's me who looks away first, me who hurries off to the shed with my basket, pretending I've imagined it all. The woodshed is ancient, windowless, and so rickety it sags on its dry stone foundation. Henry talks about knocking it down and putting up a new one, but there's always something else to do. For now, it keeps the wood dry, but only just. A plank of oak bars the door. I shove my basket into the crook of my arm and wrestle the thing out of its rusted iron brackets. I'm almost inside when I hear something, a sound that might be wind in the trees or might be voices. I slip around the side. There's no one there, just an old tin bucket and a pile of filthy rags. I leave them for now, too cold and too mindful of Jemmy to think of putting them away. But my legs won't move. I can't shake the feeling that someone has been there, is still there. I listened to the quiet beneath the wind, an uneasy kind of quiet, the sound of bodies gone still, breaths being held. The hair on my neck bristles. More silliness, I tell myself as I turn back to the shed and step inside. The moon spilling through the open door is all the light I have as I make my way to the pile of seasoned firewood Henry has put by for the winter. I have just picked up the first log when the wind slams the door and darkness swallows me. Before I can move, I hear the plank drop into its brackets, a telling thud that makes my blood run cold. I grope my way back to the door, already knowing I will find it bolted from the outside. I call out, but there's no answer, just the fading scrape of feet, and then silence. It's several minutes before I catch the first whiff of smoke, before my heart leaps into my throat and I realize what's happening. I grope at the door, but there is no handle, nothing at all to grab hold of. I throw my weight against the wood, screaming in a voice that isn't mine, a voice made wild by rage and panic. No one comes. I will myself to go still to get my bearings. Moonlight leaks through the chinks in the walls, turning the air gray in places. For the first time, I see the fingers of smoke curling between the bone-dry boards and remember the pail and the rags, and I know sickeningly why they were there. I wonder if Suzanne is still watching from her window, and I wonder where Maggie is. It's a hideous thought, but there's no time to complete it. There is the sudden, oily stench of kerosene, then a roaring rush of wind as the back wall goes up. The flames spread like liquid, lapping up the tinder-dry walls and a winter's worth of firewood. The air boils around me, hot and thick as tar. When the coughing starts, it nearly drives me to my knees. I try again to call for help, but I realize very soon that I must choose. Breathe or scream. The smoke is too thick now to do both. Behind me, I hear the pop of wood knots as they catch and explode, spewing sparks into the searing air. There is a peculiar kind of wind in the tiny space, a storm of smoke and ash, and my mind flashes back to fist-thumping sermons about fire and brimstone and the wages of sin. My eyes are streaming now, my face running with tears and sweat and mucus. There is a hideous rasp in my ears. It takes a moment to realize it's the sound of my own breath, a wet grinding that fills me with terror. I drag my scarf down over my mouth and nose, but it does no good. I can see a little, but only because the flames are raging on three sides now, splashing my shadow against the door in a grotesque sort of dance. I hurl myself at it, clawing at the wood until I feel splinters drive beneath my nails. The door holds. There is nowhere to go. When my legs buckle, I go down like a sack of corn. I don't get up again. There's no reason to get up. How long, I wonder? How much will I feel, and for how long? I need to pray, but I can't pray. I can't think. There's something I need to remember, something I need to do. I reach for the thought, but it slips away, lost in the ashy air. I've stopped coughing, or if I haven't, I can no longer hear it. The sounds around me begin to grow faint, the smoke like a blanket curling tighter and tighter. There isn't much time now, I know. I think of Henry and Maggie and Mama. Pray, I tell myself. Pray now before it's too late. Instead, I wonder who will comfort my poor boy when he wakes up alone in the dark. Chapter 38. The smoke has already taken me by the time Henry arrives. I feel no pain, only a queer sense of detachment from my arms and legs as Henry yanks me out into the cold, clear night. His hands are on me, on my face, in my hair, his lips moving silently, prayerfully, urging me back to him. But I am gone, capable now only of watching his misery, as if I am caught in a dream from which I cannot seem to wake. Finally, he seems to understand. It is a terrible moment. I long to touch his shoulder, his face, to comfort him, but that is no longer possible. He is as out of reach for me as I am for him. How cruel it seems to me in that instant that when the body dies, the heart must live on, that in the quick and quiet snuffing of our flesh, love turns to loss and joy to ache. Unfinished things we must carry through our separate eternities. Henry's cheeks are soot-streaked and shiny with tears as he carries me to the barn and locks me inside. His clothes are scorched, his hands and face already blistered. By the time the police arrive, the fire has begun to burn itself out. Only a heap of smoldering wood remains, coughing occasional showers of spark up into the breeze. He's numb as he answers their questions, his eyes hollow as they continually shift back to the barn, where he has left me cocooned in an old wool blanket. When they leave, he goes to the cottage to check on Jemmy, asleep like an angel in the narrow bed we used to share. He tucks the poor little thing up in a blanket and scoops him onto his shoulder, then carries him downstairs and across the lawn. Everything in me rails when I see what he means to do. I don't want my boy in that house or anywhere near that woman, but he cannot hear me, and so up the stairs he goes. Maggie doesn't stir when he pulls back the covers and slips him in beside her. I wonder what she will think when she wakes to find Jemmy beside her, and what Suzanne will think. He comes back to the barn then and locks himself in with me. He wipes the soot from my face and touches his lips to mine, whispering all the while that he is sorry, so very, very sorry. I almost believe I can smell the smoke clinging to his clothes as he draws up a chair and drops down beside me. I cannot, of course. I am beyond such things. But there is some small measure of comfort in feeling connected even by this tenuous thread. He's still at my side when the sun comes up. He has watched over me through the night while I have watched over him. I have never put much stock in the idea of messages from the beyond, but now I find myself praying that there was at least some tiny shred of truth in all the charlatans back home, with their candles and their crystal balls. In the only way I know how, I beg him, and the angels too, to watch over my boy, to keep him safe from whoever bolted that shed and struck the match, to please, please, send him to Mama. Chapter 39. Bad news always did travel fast in Gavin. There's an article in the paper the next morning, but I am not mentioned. No one knows I was inside, and Henry does not tell. I'm glad he doesn't. No good can come from the questions that would arise. I am gone, and nothing will change it. Hollis Snipes has already seen the paper when Henry walks into his hardware store to buy a load of pine. Hollis guesses he means to put up a new shed, and Henry doesn't tell him any different as they load the boards into the back of the old truck. He waits till the sun is down and the hands have all gone home for the day before locking himself in with me again and setting to work. He measures and saws and hammers all night, sanding and fussing over the joinwork like he's building a bed instead of a box to bury me in. His hands are bandaged now, but he seems not to feel his burns as he works. When he's finished, He lines the inside with the quilt from our bed and shuts me up inside. He sleeps for an hour or two then, until the sun comes up, his backside on a stack of old wood crates, his head on the lid of my box. It's the first sleep he's had in 2 days. He looks awful when he finally wakes up. His face is ashen, his eyes red-rimmed with smoke and sorrow, smudged with the blue-gray shadows only grief leaves behind. At the cottage, he changes clothes and downs a cup of coffee. Maggie doesn't ask any questions, just gulps noisily and blinks 2 big fat tears when he asks her to look after Jemmy a while longer. She knows all too well what has happened and what her father has been about. He drives me to the top of the ridge then, to our place. It takes every ounce of strength he has left to dig that hole and get me in it. He's on his 3rd shovelful of dirt when he begins to sob in earnest. The reality of the deed striking full force as the top of the box begins to vanish into the earth. It's a terrible sound, like a wounded animal or a very young child, and I'd give anything then to touch his face once more, to say I'm sorry for leaving him. He stays there on his knees until he's all cried out and his lips are blue with cold, one hand clutching his book of poems, the other resting on the fresh mound of earth that covers me. I can feel the warmth of his fingers leaching through the soil way down into my bones. But I want him to go now. He needs warmth and food and sleep. There's nothing more to be done for me.
Chapter 40. Leslie. Leslie flipped over the last page and closed her eyes, her throat scorched with unshed tears. She had no idea what time it was. She hadn't been out of the house in 2 days, unable to step away from the pages Jay had left on her doorstep. She saw now why he'd earned the moniker Master of Heartbreak. He had done an amazing thing, capturing both the joy and the sorrow of Henry and Adele's love, page after page of emotions so raw they stung, spun out in a voice that felt like memory. She had devoured it all greedily, the grief of a girl longing for home, the awakening of a young woman's heart, the joy and shame of a love that should not be, and finally, a life cut tragically short. Leslie shivered as she recalled the fire chapter. A young mother deliberately murdered in such a hideous way. It was inconceivable. But fires didn't start out of nowhere, and doors didn't bolt themselves. Her mind and stomach were churning again. In her mind, she could feel the splinters wedging beneath her own nails, taste the smoke at the back of her throat. And yet, he'd never so much as hinted that he thought Adele's death might have been anything other than an accident. In fact, he'd gone to great lengths to dissuade her from that notion. When had he changed his mind? He'd mentioned once that Maggie had a secret that tormented her in her last days. He also said he was glad she'd never told him what it was. She had asked him why, but hadn't given his response much thought. Now suddenly it made her uneasy. Sometimes when you love a person, there are things you'd rather not know. Like it or not, she needed